acoustic modeling and similar apparatus to try to determine what's going to happen. All of the predictions turned out to be on the high side, and the actual noise level is not greatly dissimilar than a single engine fan. The same was true at MTS and at the other stands down south. Never became a problem acoustically. There was some radiant problems with the radiation back having an adverse effect on some of the electrical harnesses.
Is that why you armored them later on?
No. This is on the armored harness. Have in some locations where the harness connects onto the connector itself, have a little rubber boot around them. We found that black rubber boots didn't make it, but red rubber boots did. They had just that much difference in emissivity, apparently. While we had black rubber boots on, we found that we were starting to cook them. So for stage static tests, we simply wrapped them with aluminum tape, and that was quite sufficient to protect them. Not a flight problem on these things. It didn't really radiate anything. It was principally cosmetic. But we came up with a lot of little problems like that. The trauma associated with the early stage testing at MTF was pretty significant, because those were all very complex operations, difficult to implement, and we were indeed having trouble making the propellant quality on the oxidizer system, in particular because of the thermal cycle system and so on. But eventually all of this was worked to everybody's satisfaction. By the time we actually got the launches, it was very little of this that caused us to impact.
The armored electrical harnesses are basically the same on the F and J, and they were primarily designed as a safety feature in the event there was a fire in the engine area, that you could affect a safe engine operation and shutdown without burning through the electrical system. Both engines, needless to say, rely on electrical power to shut them down. So it's a very bad failure mode if you burn the harness to the stop solenoid of the engine. Can't stop it, and the only way you can stop it is let the tank run out of propellant. So that's primarily why the harnesses were armored the way they are, to provide a high temperature, relatively short time, but in the neighborhood of like 5-10 minutes of operation at 2,000 degrees without burning through the harness, which is sufficient to allow the engine to withstand quite a severe fire and still be able to shut the thing down safely.
There were a lot of configuration changes and a lot of initial design features that were the results of ground rules as far as man rating safety is concerned. It's hard to say how many of those would have caused failures had they been allowed to go current design practice as opposed to the armored harnesses. It's not obvious that you'll ever know. Certainly there have been several significant in the history of the J-2 flight situation, there have been several significant failures. The first being the problems that occurred on 502 when the 1S2 engine shut down, and subsequently because of a stage wiring problem, two engines shut down. So there was the one that had a real engine problem, and then later on in the same flight, we were unable to restart the S4B engine. The detective work that went into that was pretty significant. I don't know, have you seen that progress report movie?
Yeah, I looked at it. Do you want to, we don't want
to
talk about it anyway?
Yeah. Like
yeah.
Oh, all right. that was an instance of a Flexo's failure, as you're aware, which had different characteristics on the S2 engine than on the S4B engine. Technically, it was very hard to relate the two together until studies actually confirmed the whole thing. We did with, and this is another instance where both Marshall and Rocketdyne collaborated to good end result. We ran tests here, they ran tests there. It was interesting that the tests came to fruit within a day or two. We ran the S4B test, test case at Santa Susana, and completely demonstrated the failure mechanism with a fairly elaborate test rig, to everybody's satisfaction. And about a day later, they ran Bobtail stand, and with the assembly trimmed differently to reflect the differences in S2 configuration. And those were principally differences in the oxidizer orificing of the augmented spark igniter unit that caused the situation to be different. Their failure mode demonstrated it so completely that not only did they show all the desired operational characteristics of the igniter system, they even eroded out a piece of the injector, tossed it into the nozzle, and suffered exactly the same misalignment in the same quadrant as the flight had shown. Just a little more than just good fortune, I think. But the net result was that by working very hard at both ends of the country, we were able to solve the failure, to reconstruct from the flight data what had happened, to, beyond a reasonable doubt, convince anybody with technical credentials that we knew what had happened. Then taking that data and going to the laboratory, we were able to show in the laboratory the mechanism for failure. It's Flexhold's failure in a vacuum environment. Break it down into its component parts as far as what was the vacuum contribution, what was the flow dynamic contribution, and so forth. Understand why it only occurred at flight. Implement changes to the design and qualify those changes in time to fly again without any significant delay in schedule. That was all relatively costly, but it was kind of mandatory in my mind to keep it going, to keep the flight to the moon push on, or perhaps the country would have lost interest completely at that point.
You say it was costly. Did that come out of your hide in the cost plus incentive, or?
I don't think so. I think it was work performed, and we were, compensated for it. Now I don't know how it affected our fee structure. I wasn't involved in that at the time. I labored mightily for a couple of months there, trying to duplicate the S4B failure and convince our management that I wasn't crazy. The test. I've never been so happy to see a green flame in my whole life. I've burned a lot of copper assemblies to the ground, but that was one I wanted to get. Augmented spark igniter was indeed copper. It's a principally copper assembly. And when I saw the green fire at the area here, I was delighted. The results in terms of the physical hardware that came out of that was pretty impressive. That the engine would even attempt to run, it would not be blown to bits in any subsequent attempt to start it. It's kind of beyond a lot of people's comprehension. The 503 Pogo, which was the precursor of the 508 Pogo, caused us to run the center in the engine shorter durations, was a pretty significant point. The 504 third burn experiment was certainly one of the more significant events in the flight history of the J2 engine. In that particular instance, we were running what was hoped to be a verification of a flight mission rule, which had been in effect for a significant period of time. The mission rule dealt with contingencies involved in a failure to recirculate propellants for S4B restart, and it caused certain actions to take place. Not everybody was really convinced that those actions were proper, and we had propellant and so forth, so prior planning caused us to put it in on 504. Or a third burn experiment after the crew was off and everything was all done. The engine started, and about 40 or 50 seconds in, I recall it vividly, I was in the CIF at the Cape at the time, reading numbers back over the phone to our people back here, just in a relatively bored voice. All of a sudden, the numbers were dropping, and it didn't seem to make any sense. But indeed, what apparently had happened was that we had gone into full-blown combustion instability in the J2 during the start transient. The net result of that full-blown instability was not as you would predict for virtually any other rocket engine system ever made. If it goes in, a large rocket engine goes into instability, it destroys itself in a fairly short period of time. It's not true of the J2. We knew prior to that flight that it would run 4 or 5 seconds fully unstable without apparent engine damage. Subsequent to the flight, we did indeed go into another test program that caused us to drive the assembly unstable, drive the engine unstable in transition, and sit and watch. We ran it for some 100-plus seconds, duplicated, in essence, all of the flight situations. The decay in performance was due to loss of pneumatic pressure and attendant valve positions and so forth. And there again, we were able, even though there were no accelerometers on that flight, to prove to people that we had actually seen full instability, we were able to reconstruct from the flight data, hypothesize the instability, and demonstrate it beyond a reasonable shadow of a doubt that this is what had occurred on the third burn. Subsequently, the flight mission rules were changed, a considerably different pattern, which will prevent the engine from ever going into an unstable region. This unstable region was as a result of excessively cold temperatures that the flight mission rule situation imposed. It's not necessary to be that extreme. We now know enough about it that the flight mission rules now would probably affect a safe start even without recirculation. Then the final significant flight problem that the J-2 has lived through was this 508 shutdown problem. We got back into the POGO business again. Those areas are the known problem areas that we did not have design factors enough to stay out of. How many other problems we would have gotten into if we hadn't implemented things like armored harnesses and redundant accumulator, helium accumulators, and so forth. That's an imponderable.
When you were talking before, there were just one or two, I think, minor things that occurred to me, but at one point you said that you went from a gold solder to a lead solder.
Yeah.
In some of these assemblies.
The
why do that? Is that?
I guess I'd have to beg off on a detailed technical answer, except that there were some problems with the gold printed circuit boards, PC mm-hmm. boards, that had been utilized in the original design. And it went from the gold to what you would nominally think would be a less satisfactory material.
That, yeah.
But apparently, as a result of utilizing other design techniques, the and the solder approach, it was an improved design. That was not part of my game at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really get very specific with you as to why.
And something else I remember from the film that we saw, and I can't remember really the name of the component. Maybe it was the electrical control assembly, but there was something that in the film that we saw earlier that said this is a real advance in the state of the art. And it seems to me it was some kind of printed circuit board. Is that what we're talking about here, the electrical control
yeah.
assembly? What made that such an advance in the state of the art? Why was it so much different than anything you'd done before?
Got a whole sheet on that. I asked, actually, with respect to the technology items, and that sort of breaks away from the configuration a little bit. As I got the charter from Bob Fontaine the day before yesterday, the charter was, well, what things did you do at the inception of the design? And if you look at any brand new design, you can say, well, gee, that's something we've always done, and that's something we've always done, and there's something that's brand new. We've never done that before. We've only done it on experimental models and so forth. So that's kind of a technology item. It seemed to me that technology items on the J-2 fell principally in several areas: turbo machinery, thrust chamber assembly, and the electrical area. I asked the appropriate members of supervision in those three areas to put together a little bit of a list for me on that, where existing technology had been utilized in the J-2 engine system design. Actually, Joe has, I think, probably a much better list with respect to the F-1 than I did with the J-2. He got started on it a little bit earlier and has had several, has just been able to put more manpower on it in the intervening period of time. The technology sheet, which I'll give you a copy of, talked about connectors as well as ECAs and so on. And we can all look at it for the first time together. I haven't really gone through this particularly. It's all on one page, and it really all comes down to the fact that we had no previous rocket engine experience along this line. What we were doing was reducing electronic industry state-of-the-art and incorporating it into a rocket engine. A rocket engine is kind of unique in many respects, especially an altitude-type rocket engine, where you're talking vacuum conditions and relatively large temperature extremes, as well as the high vibration, potentially high vibration environment. Those three things tend to take a component that might be perfectly acceptable in a tape recorder that sits on a desk or gets bumped around in your briefcase, and reduce it to something that's non-usable relatively quickly. It was just kind of a leap into the next century as far as rocket engines were concerned, with respect to the electrical control assembly. Joe's engine really doesn't have any similar type of control apparatus on it. It gets most rocket engines to this point have accepted control signals from the stage, principally.
Mm-hmm.
The J-2 was a little bit novel in that respect. you folks don't have any real strong electrical controls. Everything is hydraulic.
Yeah,
and everything
relative to solid state electronics and in the flight instrumentation
yeah.
system. Mm-hmm. And we did have quite a problem developing a transducer that would withstand the engine environment in the case of the F. The engine vibration on the F is probably, the vibration environment is probably worse than any other engine around. And it quite literally shakes everything apart. So it took quite a bit of development and several redesign attempts on transducers to get a transducer that would stand up to that vibration environment. It was primarily a vibration problem, not so much temperature extremes or things of that nature. But to get it, for instance, the flight transducer is a self-contained unit with a solid-state amplifier built right in it. It's mounted right on the engine, and the whole package is only slightly larger than the microphone assembly you're holding there. And to package amplifier pressure sensing device in an envelope of approximately that size and still have it withstand the engine environment was a real challenge. So it took several cuts at the design to come up with a transducer to do that. But on EF, that is the only solid state electronic device we have mounted on the engine.
I think your transducers, our transducers, our ECA, both of our armored harnesses. And the connectors that we used, in effect, took state-of-the-art electronic and metallurgical items and reduced them to practice, really, for the first time. Really, what's at issue?
Well, what about what did you do to the turbo pumps that you got so much extra power? Said you went from about a 225 to a 230K just really by juggling around the turbo pumps.
Actually, as you might imagine, the power requirements aren't particularly significant. The problems we faced were to be able to reliably accommodate the speed change necessary to produce the higher pressures. So we in effect beefed up the turbine wheels and their drive mechanisms, and some of the bearings and seal details and so forth, which then allowed us to uprate the speed on the turbo pump.
This is getting into metallurgy then.
A little bit. It was the sort of thing that the initial design, well, oxidizer turbine wheels had shown some tendency to crack. And a redesign was probably in order, even at the lower levels. Indeed, we retrofitted many of the 225K engines with the 230K oxidizer turbine wheel because we felt it was a much better. The hot gas sealing characteristics and so forth and the fuel turbo pump had given a lot of problems, but so these were redesigned along with the heavier turbine wheels and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now you specified three things: the turbo machinery, the electronics, and the thrust chamber. J2. Have you really talked about the thrust chamber? I mean, you.
The thrust chamber is unique in many respects, for Rocketdyne. Probably,
you won't get to this F1. We've got to do that sometime.
I really feel like
for Paul to run out of
steam. I really feel like Joe. I'm sorry. I do have an 11 o'clock meeting, so that'll kill it. Unless Paul put his hand back. All right, let's kind of go down through this list on the thrust chamber. First thing is that it was the first major application of hydrogen as a coolant to the thrust chamber in a high-pressure application. That doesn't sound like it necessarily means much, but the fact of the matter is that NBS had not yet defined all the heat transfer characteristics of parahydrogen, so you're hunting in the dark a little bit with respect to just basically what are the physical properties of the coolant fluid. There was a lot of data out on orthohydrogen and normal hydrogen, which stood still and was easier to analyze. But parahydrogen was pretty tough to analyze. And we had long since passed the point of no return when the NBS finally got around to producing data. And we were pretty convinced that by then that it would work because it hadn't burned up.
What do you mean by parahydrogen?
Atomically, there are three forms. There are two forms of hydrogen. with respect to molecular structure. Ortho is the form to which gaseous hydrogen will revert. Para is another form, and it's the form which gets produced by liquid hydrogen plants. Normal is the normal balance between the two, which is about 80% ortho and 20% para, as I recall. Okay? They have different heat transfer characteristics here, film cooling coefficients and so forth. They're different from one to the other. And at the time we embarked upon the design of the JT thrust chamber, nobody knew what para was. It's made for kind of an exciting game. Both the F1 and the J2 were large, relatively large, furnace-brazed assemblies that had never been built before in this country. All thrust chambers had been hand-brazed up until that point in time. So we had a fabrication technology item with respect to the thrust chambers. Both of them. Obviously the F1 was an even greater problem, but the J2 fit up in the combustion zone with the sponge shell in this area. Was a pretty tough problem. Placing braze back there and getting a reasonably decent bond occupied a big part of the thrust chamber world's efforts. Some of the early efforts came out with 13% bond, and you're a little bit afraid to fire that one. It's just liable to go away. The effort was successful enough that in a very short period of time, we were getting 90%+ braze bond between the tubes and the outer shell, rather consistently. There was a lot of metals application of Inconel 718, the large, high-strength, lightweight structures, was kind of new. There had been no direct prior experience within Rocketdyne systems. One of the design criteria was to fabricate a nozzle whose contour would be relatively optimum at altitude and yet would be capable of testing at sea level without significant performance losses. This had a lot of long-range ramifications, but basically there had been no previous experience along this area. What eventually happened was that we went into wind tunnel testing, evolved within Rocketdyne at the time, what we call the adverse pressure gradient nozzle. That's a nozzle where you normally think of a nozzle as you go further downstream, the static wall pressure reduces. That's not true with the J2 nozzle. The lowest level is about here. It then hooks back. Pressure increases from here to here. And the design factors that had been used caused us to believe that by hooking it back, we could get a high enough exit pressure that it would not separate. That judgment wasn't totally vindicated because we did suffer early in the development programs from separation problems of considerable magnitude. We stiffened hat bands down here and tried to beef it up and take it, and it just didn't make it. We eventually developed empirically, really, what we call a diffuser. It classically is not a diffuser at all. If you were going to put a diffuser onto a J2, that would be a classic type diffuser. It would be at least 1.5 diameters or something in the neighborhood of about 10 feet long. This one's 6 inches. It causes it to obtain full flow early and maintain full flow at levels much lower than would otherwise be allowable without the diffuser. It's a bolt-on, something we put on for ground test. Mm-hmm. And it's water-cooled. It has a little water line coming down and the film just dumps water in it. But we evolved this thing in order to allow the engine testing to continue. Because as it was, without that diffuser, which was an entirely supplementary piece of gear that we never understood we were going to have to make.
When did that come along?
60, 61, mm-hmm. 62, someplace like that.
And you used it then through the whole program?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was pretty strongly involved in that one. And we went back out, we had run some model contour chambers for performance determination. We went back out to the model cell and started in just cutting and trying. Really. The first nozzle extension, this was a 1/10 scale model, so it was about 8 inches in diameter. The first nozzle extensions that we bolted onto that thing were made of end grain pine. The model was uncooled, so duration was not a problem, and end grain pine is a pretty nice ablative, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And it sure is cheap.
Yeah.
The model shop could build it in a heck of a hurry. And we just started trying all kinds of crazy configurations until we finally found a few that worked, and we started backing up. eventually we got to the point, obviously with a 10th scale model, something that's 6 inches long isn't very big at all. And by that point, we were just chopping them out of flat plate steel and holding them on. We finally became convinced that we had something. We went over, and as you know, in early flange down here does not have a flange down here at the end. Flange. The actual J2 chamber has a flange down at the end. For bolt on of the diffuser and so forth, going out around. We went on and we actually went we thought might work. Yeah, some of my things now. Summations on beat into and close appeared overnight. And then ran and came home very good, feeling very good. People came in and cut up, feeling very good, disappeared. Chamber designs installed now is the water connect water for water for water gradient pressure put in it had done. There's no problem with supporting its weight while sitting. There is if the diffuser is bolted on, and the diffuser is pretty flimsy, so if you want to sit it down, you know, you squash the diffuser. It's just, light gauge sheet metal is all around. So you have to take the diffuser off and set it down. But yeah, it'll support. The engine weight is not terribly heavy. It's 3,500 pounds or something. Of course, the thrust structure of this tube bundle is capable of supporting that. Not too much problem.
Yeah,
either with or without
the nozzle. With the skirt on it, too, it can still sit on the engine.
Let's see, a couple
we
other...
We never have a case where you do that. We do when we install it in the single engine. As a matter of fact, that's how we install it in the single engine stand. Mm-hmm. We have a piece of ground support equipment that's a hydraulic lift table. Mm-hmm. We just set the engine right on this table, and it just lifts the whole thing straight up.
A couple other things with the thrust chamber. This is what we call a pass and a half chamber. And that was the first time we've ever done that back in the day. The fuel actually goes in here and goes down one of every three tubes in this area, turns and comes back, and this is a 3-for-2 tube splice in here. You go down, two coming back. And the slots where these then go from 3 to 2 are used to dump the hot gas back into the nozzle of the chamber. Similarly, hadn't been done previously in Rocket Dyne. So the 1.5 pass with the turbine exhaust gas dump, which entirely self-contained within the engine, was a new feature that had some performance advantages and obviously was neater from the standpoint of the envelope.
Yeah, excuse me, what really, as I just was thumbing through this, who prepared this list?
Well, I guess I'll have to take
where'd
responsibility
it come from? Yeah.
For it.
Okay.
I asked the program managers on, the managers of the thrust chamber, turbo machinery, and electrical areas to give me a list of technology. And in this list, they put some rough ideas together, and this list was put together by one of my folks by the name of Bob Taylor from their input.
Mm-hmm. So he kind of collated all these things.
Yeah, he started it about 2 o'clock yesterday to collate.
Yeah, because it's a very valuable sheet of stuff, I think.
Actually, it breaks down along those lines.